Welcome to Joy Connection, your journey to well-balanced living podcast series. Please welcome your host, Ralph Weaver.
Hi, I'm Ralph Weaver, and welcome to EWC Joy Connection, Journey to Well-Balanced Living. Thank you for being here. Today's topic is one that hits close to home to many of us, grief. I know it can seem like a dark topic, and why would we want to talk about that when we are a show that literally has the word joy in our title? Don't they seem contradictory? Well, I'm here to tell you that as sad as a topic grief can be, when faced with it and coming through the other side, it's important to find the joy again. Over the past year, I have lost several special people in my life, and I'm still grieving. I often think of my beloved friend Valerie, and sadness still fills my heart. Intellectually, I know she would want me to go on with my life and live it to the fullest, but I'm still a work in progress. Today's guest not only has experience with grief, but Jill Johnson Young is a clinical therapist in private practice and a former hospice social worker. She is also a certified grief recovery facilitator. Jill loves doing speaking engagements about healthy grieving and recovery from loss. She has trained over 1,000 therapists in approaching grief in a way that works. Jill received her BA from the University of California, Riverside, and her MSW comes from the University of South Florida. Furthermore, Jill understands this topic from a personal space. While in her 40s, Jill lost her first wife, Linda. Then, Jill lost her second wife, Casper. Casper was her first wife, Linda's hospice nurse, and now, Jill is married to her third wife, Stacy. Stacy is the mortician who cared for both Linda and Casper. I am so excited for you to hear this story from Jill's point of view because her humor and positivity will certainly leave a smile on your face. Please welcome our guest, Jill Johnson Young.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. And thank you for that kind introduction.
Well, Jill, you know, in reading your book, and we're going to talk about that a little bit later, but I think this topic of grief is what so many of our listeners will be able to relate to. And can you tell us what made you decide to become a clinical therapist? Was there a particular incident that made you decide that this is what I want to do to help others?
Well, you know, as a social worker, many of us earn our degrees and then work in a variety of ways in our field without getting licensed. And the license is sort of the icing on the cake when you decide to go into actual pure clinical work. So I had been working as a social worker for many years, and I did my license because my first wife, Linda, was like, you've got to get it. You need to finish it. I'm going to be dead, and you need to have that as backup in case you decide to change things up. And you're going to be raising the kids on your own. You got to get your license. So it was sort of that culmination of many years in my career and knowing that I could do more and go further and reach more if I had my license under my belt.
Now, did you resist when you were advised to go and pursue your advanced degree? Did you say, oh, no, why do I need to do this? Or could you hear the message?
You know, I did my degree years before I got my license, and I did it because I absolutely knew I needed to. I didn't necessarily want to spend the time because when I did my MSW in Florida, I had to drive an hour and a half each way to school at night. And I was in school year round for 3 years. So there was no break time, no off time. The only time Linda and I had our date nights were in the car. Going back and forth. She'd finish her shift at 3 p.m. at the hospital as an ER nurse. I'd finish at 5 at hospice. We'd get in the car, drive to Tampa. I'd go to school, during school, she was making copies for me in the reserve reading room, because that was before we had, something called the internet for the most part. And then we'd reverse course and go home. And our time together was spent in the car. But that was amazing time. I'm so grateful for it. And then the license in LCSW land, you have to earn at least 3,000 hours of supervised time before you can sit for your exam. And I did that three times because I kept throwing my hours away because life got in the way. But I finally took the exam a month after she died and passed it. So I look at it as a gift to her and a gift to the rest of my life that I actually finally sat down and did the darn thing.
Well, with your comfort level, and I want to be respectful about what you're comfortable in talking about with our listeners, if you could share with us your story, starting with your marriage to Linda before she was sick, to where you are now.
Sure. And I'm an open book. If anybody Googles me, you'll find a lot of my story. I have found that I am much more authentic if people understand that I've walked the walk instead of just having the degree. Linda and I were together for 23 years. We got married the first time in our first year together before there was such a thing as domestic partners. And then we became domestic partners. And then we got married in San Francisco when we could, and then we were annulled by the Supreme Court because they could. And in the middle of that, we adopted two of our three kids who were older adoptees. Carrie was 7 and Chloe was 5 when we got them. And then we got married in 2008 during a brief window in the middle of Prop 8. And by that time, Linda had already survived breast cancer in Florida. And when we found her breast cancer, it was stage 3. She already had metastases. They threw everything at her, and she died cancer-free. She was so proud of that, and I honor that in her. But she had a drug for the chemo that causes loss of lung and heart function, and that ultimately led to her developing pulmonary fibrosis and heart failure. So she died in 2010. The day we got married was the week we were told she was actually terminally ill in 2008. Her doctor said, "You're going to be pushing up daisies soon." So we made our minister promise to not say "till death do you part," and nobody noticed it. And she died in April of 2010 on Good Friday. And by that time, we'd taken placement of our third child, Charity, who was just turning 16. I adopted Charity as a single parent not too long after that. And while Linda was sick, she became very close to Casper, her hospice nurse. They were two peas in a pod. They thought the same way. They loved chocolate the same way. I didn't know they were developing this friendship because I was off at work. Ultimately, before Linda died, she started saying, "Jill, after I die, you got to marry Casper." And I said, "You're alive. This is not Fantasy Island." They canceled that show. And apparently Fantasy Island is back. And I ended up meeting up with Casper for coffee after Linda's death. And we hit it off. In addition to having the shared connection to Linda, Linda was right. We were very much alike. Those two were very much alike. Casper and I ended up together. We got married the next year. To everyone's consternation, I broke all the freaking widow rules, because widows are not supposed to smile too much, be happy too much, or get remarried. And then after the first 6 months of our life together, we ended up with Casper sitting on a lanai in Hawaii, throwing her coffee cup without meaning to. It just flew. And she said, "I don't know what happened, but I had these weird dreams last night and it felt like it was real. And I couldn't tell what was real and what wasn't." That was the beginning of Lewy body dementia. She was not diagnosed until 6 months before she died. And she died in the very end of 2013. Of Lewy body dementia, which is the same thing that caused Robin Williams to take his life. And in the middle of all that was Stacy, who came and took Linda into her care when she died, came and helped to take care of Casper after reading blogs that I wrote about Casper's condition and seeing how tired I was and how few people were helping. Because when you remarry, people vote with their feet and they disappear. And now Stacy and I have been together for 8 years. So yeah, that's the life in a nutshell. How's that for a presto change-o?
I'm just sitting here just amazed at how did you find that fortitude or that strength to move on after such losses in such a short period of time?
You know, what most widows and widowers say is, I didn't have any choice. When Linda died, I had three teenage girls who were a year apart. Let me just say, I didn't plan them and I wasn't present at the time they were born, but they were very close in age, and three teenage girls is a lot. And when it came time for Casper's death, I was also utterly exhausted. I'd been a caregiver then for 3 years with dementia, for 4 years with pulmonary fibrosis, and a year with breast cancer. So I was just not quite 50, and I'd been a caregiver for about 25% of my lifetime. That's a lot. It's exhausting. And that's one of the things that I talk about when I am given the opportunity to do speaking gigs, is intimate partner loss and how important it is to allow intimate partners where their coupledom has died to be able to, if they choose to, reach out and reconnect with someone, because you can still be an intimate partner. But when someone is ill, the physical intimacy needs fall by the wayside as you become a caregiver. So it's that the need to be able to have someone put their arms around you is important. And it's not something other people are comfortable with, because they want you to become the Blessed Virgin Mary when someone dies. Like, yeah, no, I'm certainly not that.
So
put me in that box.
So talk a little bit about that. What society says the traditional grief rules are, since you threw them out the window, but what is it that society says? I think we all have some idea, but if you could elaborate on that.
Sure. And you know, it's funny that the week after I was widowed the first time, a friend of mine took me out for coffee, and she's like, I know you're going to break the rules, so I'm going to tell you what they are first, so you're aware of them, because they're not printed anywhere, but we all have to tell our fellow new widows about them so they can be prepared for the responses they get. And so what they are basically is, don't smile too much because people won't think you're grieving properly, but don't look too sad because you'll make other people sad and uncomfortable. Don't forget to talk about the person who died, but don't talk about them too much because that'll make people feel weird. And if you're a widow, make sure that you are not seen dating. And if you meet anyone for coffee or a meal, make sure you're 30 miles from home, so that nobody will spot you, because every town is a small town when it comes right down to it. And make sure that you are grieving, but not too much, making people feel like you're okay. And if someone says to you, boy, I'm so sad about your loss, let me just tell you how hard this is for me. It is the former caregiver's role to then turn around and start caregiving for those who are grieving the loss, who are outside the inner circle, which is not fair, because it's supposed to be that the energy goes inward. When someone has had a loss, the primary grievers are supposed to be the ones getting the support, and they end up turning around and supporting those around them. So there's a lot of rules, and nobody talks about them.
And then we wonder why people make them or say the wrong things, or don't provide you with the support that someone grieving needs. So it all makes sense. So was that the impetus for you writing The Rebellious Widow? And as you say on your website, this book is for couples as they face a terminal illness, grievers, families and friends of grievers, clergy, funeral directors, therapists, and women's clubs. Grief is a universal experience. We all need to know how to manage it successfully. So first, I want to say congratulations on this book. But how did it come about, and what was the process like in writing the book?
The book basically wrote itself to some degree, because the whole time Linda was sick and Casper was sick, I wrote a blog. And I wrote about what was happening during the day. And I wrote it with my sense of humor, because I do have a very sick and twisted sense of humor. But I wrote about the things that were happening and what happens when we went to the hospital and people tried to take Casper and deal with her by themselves when I warned them not to. And, You know, when people come to the house to see Linda and they want to stay too long, and I had to throw them out because you can't, it's not fair to exhaust the dying person. That's just not okay. So I wrote all these blogs and I published them. And then if somebody wanted to, you know, be part of the process, they knew what was happening. And if they didn't want to be part of it, they had the information, because I didn't have the energy to return phone calls, texts, and emails. It's too much stuff for someone who's working and also caregiving and trying to do the anticipatory grief and take care of their kids. So I took all my blogs and they came out to something like 350 pages, which is too many. It's too many words, too much stuff. So I put them together and then I met with an editor and I said, I want this to be something that helps the next person, not autobiographical, because nobody wants to read somebody else's sad story. And so I let her help me shape it. And then we took bits of the blogs to kind of flesh it out. But it needed to be the book that says, you've got someone who's got an illness. It's going to be a serious one. This is what to do. And so the book website also for free has downloads about how to make a medical notebook. So you can document everything and be ready for doctor visits and people to come visit. It's got all the things you need to do to practically manage the process. I wanted people to know not to be afraid of hospice, because most people still are somehow. I wanted them to know you could fire a bad hospice and interview for a good one. I wanted them to know what the dying process looks like, because we don't talk about that. And Hallmark does a really lousy job of it. Hallmark, if you're listening, hire me. I'll help you do the dying scenes, okay? Because you do it wrong, right? That thing about the kid with the red shoes running in the snow, that is not real life. And then I wanted it to be, it's okay if you decide to be Betty White and never remarry. Or if you want to be Jill and remarry within 6 months, it's up to you. It is your grief. You get to do it your way. They're your rules now. That's why.
And so the book is really in two parts. Correct me if I'm wrong here, but the first dealing with how you get through the illness, hospice, and the dying process. And then the second dealing with more of the traditional so-called rules of grieving. But you really try to provide a boots on the ground, practical information for people
that they can then use.
Okay.
Right.
And I'm curious.
People aren't used to this.
Mm-hmm. Curious as to what kind of reaction you've gotten from people that have read the book, and what are they saying? I'm sure you get emails, letters from people saying.
I get things like, I wish I had read this a long time ago. Where has this been all my life? I wish I'd read this before my partner died. This is the book I'm going to use with my clients from now on. This is not what I expected. It's just so practical. It really isn't sad. Your sense of humor makes it okay. I didn't know it was okay to laugh when someone's grieving. I didn't know some of these suggestions for what to do when someone's had a death. Like, bring the food, but bring it in tinfoil so it doesn't have to be, the dishes don't have to be returned, and don't talk to the kids about the dying unless you're invited to, right? But do make sure you never, ever say they're in a better place or you needed another guardian angel, and those kinds of things that people say to grievers because they don't know what else to say, right?
Because, Jill, one of the things that I really related to in the book, when you write about people just coming over and sitting, and I know they're well-intentioned, but mm-hmm. it's like, it's almost as though the person, the caregiver, as well as the person that is transitioning, is, they're tired, and to just sit there, and then they find themselves entertaining people that mean well, that are coming over to provide support. So when you were talking about giving people specific things that they
can
do,
I just
said, yes, I wish I had known that when I was going through with different loved ones. Because again, that person that would just come and sit in the living room for 6 hours, you say, go home, go home, go home. You're not helping me.
I am the hospice social worker who puts signs on people's doors saying no more than 15 minutes.
Mm,
and okay. That way the family could point at that And if it was someone they didn't want there that long, they could say, look, the social worker said only 15 minutes. It's time for you to go. And if it's someone they wanted there longer, they could say, except you, you're the exception. Right. Mm-hmm. But it gave them that permission, because somehow we all feel like we don't have permission to direct the process when someone's dying. When in fact, you know, I was talking to a end of life doula on my Friday grief chat last week, and she's like, you know, we plan the births for months. We plan weddings for years. We don't plan end of life. And it takes us off guard all the time. We should plan for it. We should know what we want. We should know who we want. We should have that in place. And that's exactly right. We should have a dying process list so that if somebody comes and wants to plant themselves, we can evict them and have them go to the grocery store instead, right? Or have them go run the laundry or do whatever, so that we are not using what precious energy we have for someone that doesn't need to have that energy expended. A dying person in general is usually pretty short of breath, regardless of what they're dying from. They're pretty short of energy. They're not eating. They're not getting a lot of liquid intake. They don't have a lot of reserves. And so to use up their reserves is not fair. That should belong to the primary family.
And also, the dying person, when they want to share information and talk with you, and I'm only speaking from a personal experience with my friend Valerie, there were certain things that she was ready to talk about with me in terms of dying. And I know initially I was very uncomfortable and it was about me, but she needed to talk. And so I had to embrace listening in a different kind of way. Even though my heart was aching, I needed to hear her, and there was comfort in her words. But I think as a society, if we're not used to having those kinds of discussions, it's a little awkward.
And right, it's being able to say goodbye and give them the opportunity to say the things. It's their only chance. Let them have it.
Well, right? And you brought up something I think very interesting about laughing and just being able to smile. Tell us a little bit more about that, because I think when someone is dying, it's just that cloud that's over everyone. The sadness is just such that
it's suffocating. Isn't it?
It is.
The sadness is just like that blanket that lays over you. That's not the way I want to die personally. That's not the way that my wives wanted to die. That's not the way that anybody I've worked with in hospice, and I've sat through hundreds of deaths, and I look at all of them with reverence. Don't get me wrong. Don't anybody hear me say I don't take it seriously. I do. But there's also that inherent sense of humor that we all have. And so when someone is dying, it's important, if you're given the opportunity to talk with them, to share some of the fun stories. I will never forget XYZ when it happened, right? Mm-hmm. We were burying my grandfather, and I wish this had come up before he died, but he died a sudden death. My grandmother was talking about, on the way to the cemetery, the day that he was driving from church to church. He was a parish minister in a rural area, and the wine had bounced around in the back of the Model T. And he went behind where he was positioned at the front of the church, but the church was one room, and he got the wine open and the blood of Christ exploded all over the walls, right? And he made a joke about it, and that Christ was dripping, right? That we all busted up laughing. And then my grandmother's like, shh, 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 we have to serious up. People will think we're having a good time in the car on the way to the cemetery. But we were.
Right.
Those things are organic, and there should be organic laughter, because joy really does change the frame and it changes our brain chemistries, and we should be able to allow those things in. I suggest when I'm at a death that's starting to occur that, you know, this is the time, kids, for you to go confess everything you ever did that your parents didn't know about. Tell them about bailing out the window. Tell them about taking the car, you know. Now's the time. You're never going to be able to do it again, and it's going to really make it harder. Go tell them, and it lightens up the mood. You know, go ask your parents how they met and who kissed who first. Do that right now. Otherwise, you'll never know, right? It's those things that are important. You should be able to have some laughter and some joy the day Linda died, she was telling jokes and giving us movie trivia up till about 2 hours before she died.
And I'm sure that helped you and your daughters. I'm sure.
It totally did. It did. We watched her favorite movies all week, and she talked about stuff, and we talked about the scene in Julie and Julia with the chicken and, you know, all those things. And it brings joy still for us to talk about those moments, because that was pure Linda, right? We could enjoy who she really was before she died. That's important.
No, I would definitely agree with that. Now, and one of the things that I find is that just in families or with friends, that everyone grieves in a different way. And yep. Are there just some general tips that you can provide for the person who is reluctant to go to counseling or to talk to friends, but you see it on their face that they are grieving and they're not dealing with this and they need help?
If I see someone needing help, first of all, I'm really careful about support groups, because support groups change personality when they change leaders. And lots of support groups are religiously affiliated, which is fine if you are a religious person. But lots of people after a death are not super fond of whoever is their higher being, because they've been hearing a lot about how that higher being made a choice for their loved one to die, right? Oh, God needed another angel. This was all in a plan. And what grievers want to say to that, they don't generally, but what they want to say is, well, if he needed another angel, he could have yours and send mine back. Thanks very much. Right?
Yes.
And if this is a plan, then God didn't do so well with the planning on this one. Unicorns are very cool. My loved one dying, not so much. Right? And so you have to be really cautious when you are sending someone to something faith-based, because faith-based can be tricky. And ministers also can really blow it at funerals and cause alienation as well. And I'm not being mean to ministers right now. We have them in my family, of course, but they sometimes say stuff that's well-meaning and it causes hurt. So if you're sending someone to support group, check it out first. Make sure that you know what you're sending them to and who's in charge. I like to look for support groups that are solution focused, not ongoing, because sometimes support groups take on the personality of the least healthy person attending. And so if you've got one person in there who's all about you have to grieve forever, then everyone else gets silenced and isn't allowed to heal. And that's not healthy either. But I do suggest that folks find a really good, strong grief therapist, a therapist who knows what they're doing with grief. I went to therapy twice, and I talk about it in the book, I think, with each death. And I did that because I thought I was doing pretty well, but my business partner was like, yeah, you know, we're therapists. Someone dies, we go to therapy, Jill. It's required. It's in the rules, those stupid rules, right?
Right.
And each time, the therapist didn't know what to do with me because I had done most of my grieving in advance. When you are expecting a death, if you are able to do anticipatory grieving, you finish most of your grief before the death happens. Other people don't. And then there's usually a clash because the people around you are just starting their grief at the funeral and you're starting to finish your grief at the funeral. And the two don't collide very well. And so I went in and the first therapist said, well, you know, how are you doing? And I said, I think I'm doing really well. You know, I'm having some bad moments. I would expect that. My wife did just die. I do have 3 teen girls who are handfuls, but I'm doing pretty good. And so she pulled out the miracle question, which is, if you wake up tomorrow and everything's better, what will have changed? It's generally designed by therapists to be used to sort of create some kind of treatment plan. Well, she didn't have the power. And I told her that, I'm like, there's one thing that could fix it. And you don't have that power, honey. We need to do this differently. And then I said, and I'm going out for coffee with the hospice nurse this week. And she's like, you can't do that. You can't meet anyone for a year. I'm like, what? Who made this magic year up? And then the second one pulled the same question out and then said, Well, why didn't you get Casper checked out by a doctor before you started seeing her? Why did you marry so soon? You kind of brought this on yourself. I'm like, yeah, I'm out of here. So you got to make sure you got a good grief therapist to go to, not someone who's uncomfortable with loss themselves and sort of scrambles to try and find things to say. Was that too much of an answer?
No, it's not. It's very helpful, because one of the things that I was thinking of is, as I had mentioned earlier, you know, everyone grieves in a different way. But just right. when you think that you are dealing with the grief and you're ready to move on, sometimes something may happen that you realize that you haven't dealt with it. And you're saying all the right words, you're saying all the right things, but it could be one small incident that happens that it makes you realize, I need some help. Yes.
Yeah. Then you reach out and you find the help. Just make sure you find skilled help. Mm-hmm. Someone who knows how to talk about grief. Someone who's not uncomfortable with it. Someone who has dealt with their own losses.
But what if you're the kind of person that you're more comfortable in providing, being an excellent caregiver, and you've ignored yourself? You talk in the book about the importance of taking care of yourself as a caregiver. But how do you even know that you need help, because you've just been going on automatic? If someone has dementia or dealing with cancer and you're the caregiver, you've just been doing, and you haven't stepped back to say, oh, what about my health? What about my needs? You've ignored so much dealing with your own self.
What that you put yourself in danger. Yeah, the first thing I do with a griever who's had someone die, whether it's a sudden or a prolonged death, is send them to the doctor. And I send them with a list of labs, and I'm not practicing medicine because I don't need to know the lab results. I want the doctor to see the lab results. I want them to go get a full chem panel. I want them to check their vitamin D level. I want to make sure their thyroid is functioning. I want them to check their B level. I want them to go get their mammogram. If they're over 50, I want that colonoscopy done. Because caregivers are notorious for not taking care of themselves. And those who have sudden losses are at high risk for danger themselves in terms of inflammatory process. We know that from the research. I send my folks to the doctor, and I want them to show me that they've been, because then we can work from that process too. Caregivers also frequently have injuries because of body mechanics, because we don't teach caregivers how to lift someone, how to get that wheelchair out of the back of the car, how to pick up that oxygen tank without hurting themselves. So we really have to make sure that if someone's grieving, that they've actually taken care of themselves physically as well as emotionally.
Well, Jill, pardon my ignorance on this, but do the hospitals, you know, once you're becoming a caregiver, do they address the needs of the caregiver? I guess one could go on the internet and read what the role of the caregiver, what should I do? But does anyone address the needs of that caregiver?
No. Short answer, no. They should. And before COVID and before we got so shorthanded, which was happening before COVID, to be very clear, in healthcare, yes, there was a social worker, and they would make sure if they were discharging a patient to home that all the medical equipment was there, and they'd make sure that it was reasonable medical equipment. But we don't have that anymore. I have a dementia support group that I run every month for free. And one of the things that we work with families on is, okay, you've got a wheelchair. Do you have a transport chair so that you're not breaking your back getting that wheelchair out of the car? You know, if you've got oxygen in the house, do you have all the equipment that you need? Did they deliver the cannulas? Right? Are you being seen by the doctor too? We had somebody discharged in our support group who had a loved one who was discharged from the hospital with a new hip 24 hours after surgery, who was bedbound. And there was one person at home who has a back injury, and nobody even asked. Hmm. It was the group that got together and sort of crowdfunded the how do we make this work and how do we get her the help she needs. That's what got her the help she needs. So we don't have that really comprehensive approach to medical care that we should, and caregivers get the short end of it. And caregivers give something like 214 billion hours in care every year in this country for free.
Wow. I didn't know that is a lot. That really is.
Yeah.
Yeah, that truly is. But I wanted to bring another topic up that I'm sure you hear and see a lot, is that sometimes that when someone is dying or they have died, that it brings out the worst in families and people in general, who they're arguing about the care, they're arguing about finances and every other topic.
They're arguing about ashes.
Right.
Oh my goodness.
How do you get families to come together to what is in the best interest of their loved one, to stop all the foolishness and say, okay, how do we come together?
I try to organize family meetings, and that's actually something I do. Sometimes people will email me and say, help, this is going on. Can you meet with my family for like 2 hours one time and sort this out? And so, yeah, a family meeting, if you can get everyone to agree to sit and be nice or get on Zoom and play nice and allow some guidance from someone who's done this before, which is where the credentials of street cred help, because I have done this before, right? I'm not just a social worker. I'm a social worker who's done this in her own home. But you do have to look at who's got the strengths and who's willing to step up and who's not. Hopefully it happens before that, that someone has gotten their advance directives done and has made good choices for who's going to be decision-making, not put every single child together on a committee, because that never works. Right. If you're thinking about doing that for yourself, please stop right now. Pick one, just one, and then make a backup if that one's incapacitated. Don't make it a committee. It doesn't work, right? With dementia, people sue each other all the time. Yeah. Like 50% of dementia families have lawsuits going against each other. Wow. So we need to have a meeting where everybody can sit down. And if someone's saying, I'm not comfortable, then that's fine. You're not comfortable. We're going to leave you out of this process now and go on to those who are going to be present. But you really do have to work together and find a way to navigate it. Figure out who can give time, who can give money, who can hire, whatever it takes to patch it together. Because it's a lot to take care of someone who's at the dying process.
But Jill, that leads to my next question. How do you counsel someone who just wants to give up after the death of a loved one, that they say there's no meaning to my life? I don't want to live. What is it that you can do or say?
I go back and revisit what caused them to love that person, whether it was a parent or a child or a best friend or a pet or a spouse. I mean, there's all kinds of losses that can have that kind of impact. And what joy did they bring you? What joy came from that relationship? I try not to pull out the, they would want you to go on and live, because mm-hmm. that just doesn't help anybody. But what joy was there in that relationship? What can you draw from that? What did you want to do with your life before this person came into it? Where do you want to go with that? When you have a major loss, you have a grief card, which is like the Ace of Spades, the biggest Ace of Spades you've ever had. And you can throw it down and change everything in your life to accommodate this loss. So, no, you may not want to go do something big and spectacular, but can we get you to go outside and get the sun on your face 3 times a week? And we start small. And then once I get them moving into small bits of going for 5 minutes walk, just inside their house even, what can I do? If you're going to want all the carbs to eat, could we get some broccoli in that ice cream? Right? Or could we find a way to put some chicken on those nachos? Whatever it is, because comfort foods feel better when someone's grieving. We know that. But get some protein in there. Get some dark green veggies. Let's do little bits, because it's overwhelming at the initial part. When you have had a major loss and it's right at the beginning, it's really hard. And after the funeral, it can be even harder, because after the funeral, everyone else goes back to real life.
Yes.
Right? They're going to the grocery store and going out for dinner that night, and you're going home and walking into a house where somebody isn't anymore. And that's really hard. And if it's a loss that there's no service for, like a pet loss, there isn't even that. Although we're now starting to have pet funerals, which I really, really, really like. We should do more of those too. We need to acknowledge the loss.
Yeah, I think that's so important, acknowledging it, and also those small steps, because again, sometimes when you say joy and happiness, or it's going to come, you can't even see beyond
imagine
your day. You can't even imagine it, as you said. You can't even imagine. So those words are just so hollow. It's just, I want to feel like I'm feeling right now because it's awful and I don't know how I'm going to go on. But I think those small steps.
I've been known to text my clients in the middle of the day and say, have you been outside yet? Mm-hmm. Send me a picture of you outside. And it's just something small, but they need that. They need sort of not just a therapist. They need sort of a coach if they don't have anyone in their world to say, let's do 10 steps today, literally walk 10 steps and put some water on your face. Freshen up a little bit. Eventually, life starts to happen again. And then you can decide what you want to do with it. But you also can look at it as, this is my opportunity to change whatever it is I want to change. Something like 50% of those who lose an intimate partner change their careers because they can. Because all of a sudden life has a completely different meaning.
Well, Jill, one of the things that I am hoping through just the discussion that we're having today and all the work, that wonderful work that you're doing, that just as a society, we can become more comfortable in having a discussion like this. And as you had mentioned earlier on in the discussion about preparing and talking about it without judgment or feeling like, oh no, I can't bring, or I don't want to hear this. No, we can't talk about this. But how we can be more comfortable in having a discussion. So when a death occurs and we're never, I think, prepared for it, but at least we've talked about it and can just approach it in a different way versus it being such a taboo subject.
Right. And we do need to talk about it. I keep hoping. I've been doing this now. I was the first social worker for our local AIDS project before we had the name AIDS. So I've been doing grief and loss for a long time. And I keep hoping that at some point we're going to get to a point where as a society, we can talk about loss and grief and death like it's normal, because it is. It's something, it's universal. We all experience it. We've all experienced way more of it than we ever should have since 2020. You know, how do we get to that point where we can finally say it's okay to talk about instead of having people sort of step back? And, you know, when Stacy and I are out, my current wife, who's the mortician, and someone says, what do you do for a living? You know, bad enough that I'm the social worker. Then she says she's the mortician. And they're like, 1, 2, 3, 4 steps back. I wait for them, right? Unless I'm in a meeting filled with social workers, then they are all like, ooh, she's a mortician. I want to meet her, right? Because social workers are a little weird in general. But most people just sort of step back, therapists included. They will take a wide circle around me so that I don't talk about grief with them. And it's weird because there's so many ways we have losses in this world. We need to be able to talk about it.
No,
Whether it's retirement or jobs or schools or moving, or there's loss every day of our lives, even the car keys, right?
Yes, no, that's so true. But Jill, I could go on and on and on talking with you. The insights that you bring to this topic have just been so helpful to me personally, but I know to our listeners as well. But on our podcast, we like to end our discussions with a segment called The Shift to Joy, asking our guests what brings them joy and makes them happy. So Jill, what do you do to bring joy into your life?
I love getting on my treadmill because it clears my head. And Stacy and I adopt senior poodles who are going to be put to sleep. The vet calls us and the animal control folks call us when they've got someone who otherwise would be euthanized that day. And we go pick them up and we have a little crowd of just the sweetest old sort of ragtag poodles around us. And any given day, there's usually 6 of them. And they just are such cuties. They are fun. We watch them go from being tentative to being joy-filled and playing with their favorite toys and discovering that they can have fun and that people aren't going to hurt them. And there's just nothing more fun than seeing them out enjoying life and wanting cuddles and working together as a group. It's just the best thing in my day.
That's wonderful. Is there anything else you'd like to mention before we wrap up?
Well, I have the Friday Grief Chat every Friday on Facebook. You can find it under Humor, Grace, and Grief on Facebook. And we do just talk about grief every single Friday at 10 a.m. Pacific time. And you can find me on all my websites, JillJohnsonYoung.com and TheRebelliousWidow.com. And you will find all kinds of resources there absolutely free because I'm still a social worker.
Well, Jill, I can't thank you enough for taking the time out of your busy day to chat with us. We're greatly appreciated, and we think our listeners will be able to be inspired not only by your story, but by the changing the rules on how to handle their own grief. And thank you, listeners, for your time today. And please don't forget to share our link of the podcast with your friends and family. We love to see your comments and thoughts, so please keep them coming. And don't forget to take a little time to spread some joy today.